Dialogue Conspiracy, Mae Bressel, Carmel, California. I didn't hear the beginning here. This has been quite a day of confusion in the studio, but I guess we're on the air now and rolling along. Dialogue Conspiracy number 169, November the 4th, 1974. I saw a movie this week, The Odessa File, which is a very good film, a documentary that I recommend for people interested in research. And while the story is laid to an experience involving Nazis and the SS troop following World War II, the Odessa File is far from closed, and it's very current. And I think the movie doesn't touch on that subject, but I'd like to talk a little bit about that. This is a true story of men, Nazis, SS men, that left Germany shortly before the war was completely over, before the U.S. troops took over and the Russian troops met in Germany. It was a secret organization formed of Nazis that would restructure themselves and reorganize and come back and conquer the world later. They would go under, hide themselves, and resurface later. The members of this secret organization of SS troops moved to Germany, in Europe, Argentina, Latin America, United States, Africa, Middle East, working for the Third Reich. The particular movie is about a plan to destroy Israel, and certain rocket ships were being made to be used in Egypt, and the Germans were behind this, and there was a secret factory in Germany with a cover of respectability of electric company similar to, say, General Electric, and it was at this factory that they were making the final parts of the weaponry or rockets that would be used in Egypt to be sent against Israel. There's a character in that book, Mr. Simon Wiesenthal, who in the book, it's based upon a book by John Forsyth and also in the movie. Wiesenthal is famous for hunting down Germans, particularly who ran concentration camps, the ilk of Bormann or Eichmann, men that were responsible for mass slaughter. Wiesenthal has been living continuously for the purpose of his whole life, and energy and time is spent in hunting down Germans that took names of other dead Germans, many times Jewish families, and scattered around the world, and he would like to bring them to justice. The Nuremberg trial was really a farce in terms of pinpointing some of the worst war criminals, and Wiesenthal has worked on this. And in the movie, he's portrayed as the person who is given a notebook with the Odessa File, with a list of names of persons that belonged to the SS that took on new aliases. I had brief contact with Wiesenthal in Austria, corresponding after I completed a lot of the work in cross-filing the 26 volumes of the President's Commission on the Investigation of the Assassination of President John Kennedy. Lee Harvey Oswald was working in Minsk at a radio factory, and I had reason to believe that he was working with a Nazi of the same ilk as the Odessa, a member of the Odessa, because everybody that was associated with Lee Harvey Oswald was a Nazi and belonged to the Solidaris, which is a branch of the Odessa, and worked his pal on the bus going down to Mexico City. I've mentioned John Howard Bowen, alias Albert Osborne, was connected with the German Nazi movement. Clay Shaw, through the trademark down in New Orleans, was connected to the German Nazi movement. His friend George de Morenschild, same connections to Germany and to the Nazis, and the extreme right wing, the Solidaris. And there are many, many links of Oswald to the far right wing, to military intelligence. He stayed at the home of Michael and Ruth Payne. I mentioned before, Michael Payne, it was a designer for helicopters at Bell Aerospace, managed by Walter Dornberger, the Nazi war criminal, and Mr. von Braun, Werner von Braun of the NASA Space Agency, and the Defense Intelligence Agency were behind the assassinations of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King. So I found it very interesting that Oswald was working at a factory. There was a man there named Zeiger, Z-E-I-G-E-R, and he was very friendly with that family. And Zeiger was an immigrant who had left Europe and gone down to Argentina. then returned to the Soviet Union. Allegedly, he was Jewish and returned to the Soviet Union and was running the radio factory. The description of Oswald's job at the radio factory was, in quotes, a regulator in the experimental shop of the Minsk radio factory. He was, as I say, close friends with Zeiger, he and Rena Oswald. Volume 22, page 741 of the Warren Commission hearings describes Zeiger family from Argentine. And I wrote to Mr. Weissenthal to see if they could trace this name of Zeiger was, in fact, a Nazi of the SS, of the Odessa group specifically, and had come back for playing his small role in the assassination of the President of the United States by employing Oswald as a cover for his later having been a communist, being in Europe as a communist when he actually was an American intelligence agency all along. There was another witness before the Warren Commission, Anna Meller, whose path came from Russia to Germany to the Dallas-Fort Worth area, from Houston to Fort Worth area, who was a source of contacts and introductions. And she was allegedly Jewish, and she was part of an intelligence operation. Volume 16, page 445, in the notebook of Marina Oswald, she has the names of all of her Russian friends while she was in the Soviet Union in a rest home, and she had the name of Anna Meller, but she wasn't supposed to meet Anna Meller until she arrived in the Dallas-Fort Worth area after July 1962. And I felt that Anna Meller's contacts could possibly link to the Odessa, that she could be an agent working with the Odessa. This is the same woman that worked at the Dallas Power and Light Company, where Lee Oswald carried books and messages back and forth. And they had code names in the Dallas-Fort Worth area that I have assigned to do books and articles about, that they used in the Soviet Union. Lee and Marina Oswald had intelligence names of agents that were fictitious members of their family that they used in Dallas-Fort Worth area, that they also used in Minsk, and from the health center that Marina Oswald was rescuing in the hospital to Minsk, Lee and she were exchanging the same kinds of letters that these agents were doing when they moved back to Dallas from the Soviet Union. And it was also a member of this team that lived upstairs from Lee Oswald on Neely Street, the apartment where the famous photograph was taken of Lee Harvey Oswald allegedly holding a weapon, that superimposed picture. The man who lived upstairs, I mentioned before, worked at the Dallas Power and Light Company where Anna Meller lived. So the Odessa file is important because it happened then and it's happening now. And while the movie is the story of the organization is far from dead. The Odessa name came up in relationship to the Watergate. The Odessa operation has been hushed up, but when the White House plumbers were exposed, Hunt and Liddy, and some of their operations, they mentioned the Ellsberg operation, the Howard Hughes getaway plane that was supplied to go to Hank Greenspan's safe in Nevada. The White House plumbers were involved in some narcotics operations down in Mexico at the border, allegedly involved in that. And there were other mysterious operation that was called National Security that was not allowed to be discussed at the Senate Select Committee hearings in July 73 that had the name Odessa on them. And I think that's important because that there were Nazis, as I say, involved in the Watergate as there were in the John Kennedy assassination, and the links were very strong. The Zodiac News Service just last week talked about Germany's CIA Watergate, and they referred to the BND. This is October 21st, 1974. The BND is West Germany's intelligence agency, similar to our CIA. And the news service said they compiled illegal dossiers on about every national political leader existing in Germany. 54 of the most famous politicians have been spied upon, including former Chancellor Willy Brandt. This is interesting. I am interjecting into the news service because E. Howard Hunt wrote a book on the fall of the head of the German government, that he'd be involved with a spy later and be deposed from office. And this was written by E. Howard Hunt just 2 years ago, and then it happened to Willy Brandt. What was in the novel of E. Howard Hunt happened to Willy Brandt 2 years later. But the BND spied upon German presidents and also upon Mr. Weisenthal, the leader of this documentation center. And the parallels to our CIA were noted in the news service because the news service said that the BND, the Nazi intelligence system, was started by our CIA after World War II. And the first head of the BND was General Reinhard Gehlen, head of Nazi intelligence on the Eastern Front during World War II. But the truth of the matter is that the story is the other way around. Reinhard Gehlen, the head of Nazi intelligence and Hitler's intelligence, Eastern Europe, started our CIA. We had no basis for our National Security Council or the clandestine operations that were to take place through the whole period of the Cold War. And it was Gehlen who flew to the Pentagon and met with our Washington officials that started our CIA. Our CIA, in turn, was built up. It built up German intelligence after World War II. But Reinhard Gehlen structured how we should do it instead of the other way around. The BND was not started necessarily by our CIA. The Germans started our CIA and then created the BND, which funded millions of dollars to Reinhard Gehlen. The Odessa File, as I say, is the movie, and the book is about one particular operation, but I maintain that it's still going on. Now, June 14th, 1974, G. Gordon Liddy. There was an exposure that G. Gordon Liddy was at the National Archives. This was written up by Jack Anderson, telling how he attended private showings of Nazi propaganda films featuring Adolf Hitler. If you read the October 74 issue of Harper's Magazine, G. Gordon Liddy's article is pro-Nazi. It's German in every sense of the word. And his explanation of what he's doing at the Watergate or the purposes is consistent with the kind of showings that he attended in the National Archives in January of 71, where he's watching pictures of Adolf Hitler. As I say, there was an Operation Odessa that was mentioned, and it's been hushed up about the Watergate. We don't know what it is, but it involved Hunt and Liddy and the White House plumbers, and it would be nice to know. Another person attending those private showings of the Nazi films was Robert Mardian of the Justice Department. It was shown for members of the Internal Security Division. Liddy addressed the audience in German, and he had a fascination with Adolf Hitler. We mentioned a few weeks ago, SS agent Duke, his name is Duke. The Watergate Committee protected his name. We don't know his last name or his first name. He's got a nickname of Duke, who could be part of the current Odessa down in Miami, who is planning violence for the Republican conventions in 1972 with Hunt and Liddy and the Cubans that were arrested at the Watergate. Another matter about E. Howard Hunt, which suggests an operation like the SS, the Odessa operation in Germany, was that while Hunt is testifying before the committee, the court right now on the cover-up charges, and he's saying that he told lies previously, he would have us believe that he's telling the truth this time, although he lied to the grand jury or lied to the FBI or lied to the judge. He would have us believe he was telling the truth this time. He said that at the trials this week, even his own children didn't believe him, so he thought maybe he should tell the truth. But let me remind you, when you see the movie and you see how insidious these people are in the movie, remember it was E. Howard Hunt who at the White House had a .25 caliber pistol and ammunition in his desk. His desk contained tear gas canisters. He had microphones that were hidden in simulated chapstick containers. He had radio transmitters and various antenna and antenna wire. Important is that E. Howard Hunt had harnesses for climbing telephone poles. He had jack wires to monitor conversations, and he had two maps which showed the areas of Baltimore and Washington, D.C. with circles drawn around the highway intersections. This information came out in the San Francisco Examiner, among other papers, May the 8th, 1973. This is the kind of thing that the Odessa would do if they wanted to plan a takeover with Hunt, working with Cohart, Liddy, and Mardian, watching these Nazi films, and Hunt working with Duke, funneling money down to Miami to a member of the SS. I don't think we can take lightly what all this equipment was for. You remember, or maybe you don't remember, at the time Sharon Tate was murdered and six other people in her home, the very first thing that happened was that somebody shimmied up the pole and cut the telephone wire so that the phone was out of service. I think it was when I read that the next morning that I realized this was no hippie operation of any kind, but a military type of operation. But this is the kind of equipment that E. Howard Hunt had at his desk at the White House, or is alleged to have had. And when you see these scary spy stories, remember that the spies are still being protected in many ways. There's an article this last week that Jaworski, as he resigned from office, urged, in quotes, full disclosure on Watergate. He said there's some matters that the public has never heard about. And we'll talk about a few of those as that trial is going on there. He thought that Congress should expand their special prosecutor's authority so he could discuss information. I don't think Mr. Jaworski from the CIA really means that, but he means it when he says there's areas that they haven't gone into. But whether he wants a special prosecutor to expand, I believe that's untrue. And probably, if Richard Nixon passes away, there won't be any expansion of information. It'll all be closed up, and they'll say, let bygones be bygones. I had an interesting conversation last night on WBAI in New York. Bob Fass called, and we did about a four-hour show. Elmer Davis introduced himself to New York, to the people there that were very interested in his case as the White House scapegoat for the Dr. Fielding entry that the plumbers and the CIA did. And then there was a caller who said he'd send me information to out here to KLRB with facts that he has on the murder of Jack Ruby, the way it was done, and the way he said that Richard Nixon would be murdered. And it reminded me of the show I did on KLRB just about 4 weeks ago. But I talked at that time a few weeks ago about how Ruby had what was supposed to be a pneumonia and then a blood clot, and then they said the blood clot became cancer. And the anxieties that he had with his case coming up, he wanted a new case on the shooting of Oswald, could cause cancer. And there were similarities in Richard Nixon, who in the summer of 73, at the height of the Watergate hearings, went to the hospital with pneumonia. The summer of 74, he had blood clots, which you really get from surgery or from, it didn't explain how Richard Nixon started to get the phlebitis. And then the news media told us he could get cancer. And then there were subjects that anxiety causes cancer. I know that David Ferry, the pilot, the CIA agent that worked with in New Orleans with Lee Harvey Oswald and Clay Shaw and had been down to Mexico where E. Howard Hunt was the CIA officer, David Ferry was experimenting on cancer and inducing cancer. And he had a lot of mice running in the hundreds into his apartment. He was also a scientist in addition to an airplane pilot. He had many skills and hobbies. He was a priest sometimes, but he was very heavy into cancer work. And at the time, it sounded so far-fetched in like 1984 or something unreal that people didn't put much credence into the work that David Ferry was doing with the induction of cancer, these experiments. But this gentleman called last night, and he works in hematology and blood diseases, and I don't know whether he's a doctor or a scientist in a laboratory. And he was telling me, he said, do you know the way that Richard Nixon got sick or the way Jack Ruby was killed? And I took notes very briefly. This is what he said, and he's going to send me a more detailed letter, and I'll share it on the air. But what he said was that the way it was done, and he seems to know is a factual, not theoretical, point of view, was that they take a urine specimen. This is what he said they did with Ruby. They took a urine specimen of him and made a culture of the urine specimen, and then they inserted it back from these cultures. Now, I don't claim to know the scientific methods of this. I'm only repeating what he told me because it was new information, and he seemed to be knowledgeable of how this was done or knew people that were involved. And he said they inserted it back into the body, into food that is given to the person who's in prison or in hospital. While the person's in the hospital, you take a urine specimen, and then you make a culture of it, and you put it back so that the individual, he suggested that Richard Nixon, when he was in the hospital having pneumonia in the summer of 73, received this kind of treatment, and that this is what Jack Ruby got, only at a more speeded up rate, that they eat part of the culture back, and it affects the genetic structure of these people. It's put into their food, And then the first symptoms you get are a nagging cold. Is it what he said, having a Jack Ruby that wouldn't go away? And then penicillin follows the cold, and you begin to get injections that rapidly set up cancer cells within 14 days. I know that when Jack Ruby's sister visited him in the jail, he had never been sick before, and he seemed to be all bloated up, and the doctors were giving him injections. And then they sent him to the hospital and said it was penicillin, but they didn't do any x-ray of his chest or any stethoscope to see if he had pneumonia. They just said it's pneumonia, and were giving him injections that Ruby said they were injecting with cancer and that he was going to die. He said this just about 2 weeks before he did die, became panicky. But this person said that they inject the penicillin starts and the cancer cells are multiplying and these living organisms are going on and growing. And they're very cultured carefully and it involves entire metabolism of the body. And then he said the next complication is viral pneumonia and also it leads to blood clots and then death. I thought of the medical report on Richard Nixon this week. Some physicians might report the patient is uncomfortable or the patient's in critical condition or there's an element of risk in surgery. But we're in the 20th century with what is like the spy language of a doctor. And we heard that Richard Nixon is in imminent, there's imminent dangers lurking around the corner. I thought that was a funny medical report of imminent dangers lurking around the corner because I think everyone in the nation feels that that is the situation and that Richard Nixon is indeed in dire trouble. He said that if he went to the hospital, he wouldn't come out alive. The feeling in New York City on the talk show was bordering on outrage. It was suggested by the commentator, that people should have demonstrations against the public slaughter of Richard Nixon, and others felt that it was a purposeful thing to prolong him and delay it and let everyone know how even though we feel that he is being murdered in front of us, we're totally helpless to do anything about it. We're all drawn in. Ziegler had a press conference this week and said, "We almost lost Mr. Nixon last night. We almost lost." There's something about the whole thing that is macabre. People can't put their finger on it. They know something's wrong. And as I say, we're all helpless. There's nothing you can do. You can't send a wire to the Nixon family and say, stay away from these people. Charles Colson said that Nixon was completely surrounded by the CIA and intimated that he was in imminent danger. And yet it seems that these people don't have friends to come around and surround them and ask for their medical reports or check on what's going. And when they're in the trap or the web, and it's decided that they are going to be possessed or owned by the people that have dominated them during their political life, there just doesn't seem any way out. But we're drawn into watching this thing. And then when he finally does succumb to one of these clots, people will say, oh, he suffered enough or something. The man will be incapacitated with this hanging over his head the rest of his life. The Zodiac News Service last week had another account that I didn't get a chance to speak about. It was Bernard Fensterwald, one of the attorneys for James Earl Ray, whose name I've mentioned many times, who heads the committee to investigate assassinations, claims that Ray may have been hypnotically programmed prior to the Martin Luther King assassination to forget the identities of his co-conspirators. That's an interesting bulletin because the amount of work that I was doing just prior to the SLA, last November and December, I was getting ready to do my next article for The Realist. And the subject of the article is the use of mind control in political assassinations. And it goes into the book by Lincoln Lawrence, which is a pseudonym, on Were We Controlled? The use of surgery on Lee Harvey Oswald, hypnotism on Jack Ruby. Again, David Ferry, the same man who was doing the experiments on cancer, was a known hypnotist in contact with Jack Ruby. Billy Del Mar, the hypnotist, was at the nightclub at the time just prior to the assassination of John Kennedy and left town and was never seen again and was never called by a witness before the Warren Commission. He was at Jack Ruby's nightclub doing the acts the week of the assassination. Sirhan was hypnotized, and when you ask him, when he's asked questions about the assassination of Robert Kennedy, when he gets to a certain point, he would just shake his head back and forth with the no sign, just back and forth and back and forth. And it seemed to Dr. Simpson, Edward Simpson, who saw him, and to other psychiatrists, and even Robert Blair Kaiser, who wrote RFK Must Die, as bad book as that is, he has the feeling that Cernan has been hypnotized in some way. He doesn't say by whom, but he's been hypnotized. Well, Bernard Fensterwald brings out the point in Los Angeles that prior to the assassination of Martin Luther King, that James Earl Ray was indeed going to a hypnotist in Hollywood during this time, at least one hypnotist during the time period that he was in Los Angeles. And I might add that James Earl Ray, when he was arrested in London, had two books of hypnotism with him, whether he was studying them or told to read them or to keep up the efforts for what he was about to go into. He did have books on hypnotism that he traveled with that were an important part of his getaway from the United States on his way to Rhodesia. He had been to a hypnotist in Los Angeles, so that these things are coming out at the hearing of James Earl Ray in Memphis this week, and how much importance they can have would only be determined by who the doctors were that they were seeing. Are these doctors military-trained doctors? Were their medical school bills paid by the U.S. government? Where did they get their training? Are they psychologists, psychiatrists? I think if we really did some research into who they were seeing, not the effect it has on the men, but who were they seeing, we could develop a military pattern of hypnotism and trace how, say, Sirhan or James Ray or Lee Harvey Oswald were controlled, or Jack Ruby were controlled, to forget their contacts and relationships if they were arrested. I'm going on to a matter about the SLA, which I think is important, because last week a prisoner at Folsom was found dead in his cell. Yes, allegedly he hung himself. His name is Raymond Sparks. He used the nickname Ray Ray. He was visited four times by Nancy Ling Perry. In July 1973, he had two visits. In August and December 73, he had visits. The same day in December that Nancy Ling Perry visited Raymond Sparks, the Willie Wolf was visiting Clifford Jefferson, Clifford Death Row Jefferson at Folsom. Now, I have received letters from prisoners at Vacaville and from Soledad. I've done some shows on them, that their lives have been in danger ever since the SLA thing came down, because those that know how the SLA was formed, who are knowledgeable about Donald DeFries, their lives have become in danger. When they wanted to tell the law enforcement or their attorneys or write to me, it seems there was a contract then to murder them, because the cover story that the SLA is a radical terrorist group has to hold if the intelligence operations are going to conduct further bombings and kidnappings and acts of violence in the United States that make it look like it's radicals, then they have to hold the cover story that these are terrorist groups. Now, I know Nancy Ling Perry was visiting the prisons. I met somebody out at Soledad that she visited and offered escape if he could join the SLA if he wanted to escape. Nancy knew the mother of this boy living in Oakland, the family, and had visited him there. Only a connection with the guards or the law enforcement would give her the ability to say that he could escape and join the SLA. I maintain that she was from a military intelligence operation and she wasn't a radical, and these offers were to build up this army so that the right wing and the politicians coming up for the election and for future acts of terrorism would have something to sink their teeth into. Now, I think the reason they're killing these people is for fear that they might tell the truth about what's happening, not because they're part of the SLA, but because they could blow the whole thing open. October the 20th, Raymond Sparks was found dead in the psychiatric isolation cell, a hospital in Folsom Prison. He was strangled by radio earphone cords, and people around him are saying that he was set up for murder by the California Department of Corrections. This is coming out of an article from the Berkeley Barb, and this is what I maintain, that he's being set up by the Department of Corrections to murder, not because he's part of a terrorist group, but because he knows about the people who set up this so-called terrorist group. 12 days before his death, Raymond Sparks was sent from Folsom to Dual Vocational Institute, and he was supposed to be in the main prison population. He was promised that, but instead he was put in a maximum security unit, and they started to put drugs in his food when he got there at Tracy. Putting drugs in the food and making a person drowsy before you butcher them, it was what they were doing to Robert Hyde at Vacaville. I've talked about on the air, and he transferred his meals, shared his meal with his cellmate, and threw the one that they gave to him down the toilet because he realized that they're making him drowsy in preparation for a larger action against him. This Sparks was brutally beaten by the guards. He was injected with drugs. His body was partly paralyzed. Then he was moved back to Folsom October the 16th, just a few days before he was found dead, 4 days before. He was put in a strip cell. He was physically ill. He called his mother once on an emergency call that he was sick. He called her again October the 19th, and he was screaming. Their inmates heard him screaming, "Take me to the hospital." So evidently he wanted help. Going to the hospital, he wanted to live, but 1.5 hours after he called his mother, he was found dead, and the story is that he committed suicide. I believe that the moving him back and forth from one prison to the other, injecting him, paralyzing him, beating him, or driving him to the point, I don't believe he committed suicide, but driving him to the point and these radio cords were found around his neck, was it because he knew something similar to what this other fellow told me about Nancy Lane Perry when I was out at Soledad? He may have known something about the operation that was not meant to be told on the streets, and therefore he had to be eliminated. I have some more letters. I've read them from time to time on the air. In the last 2 weeks, I have a copy of a letter from a Mr. Fred Braswell out at Soledad. The matters aren't getting any better. I've been to the district attorney's office, Mr. Curtis's office. I've talked to investigator Mr. Kennedy about what's going on out there and the threats of death upon all the people who know about the formation of the SLA out at Soledad. The letter that I just got recently from Fred Braswell says that on Friday, August the 25th, 8:45 Whitney Hall, returning from the yard, he's noticed a subject advancing towards another witness, A.J. Meadows, from behind. There was a prison-made shank, that's a weapon. Braswell grabbed it, his nose was cut, and he brought attention that he had saved Meadows' life. He had interfered there and stopped the killing of Meadows, and the purpose of killing Meadows was that he knew about Robert Hyde, the lawsuit against the Department of Corrections taking place. Hyde has had contracts to alter his brain. They've tried to murder him. He has lawsuits. He knows about the formation of the SLA in Soledad. He knows about a lot more, too. But there's been this concerted effort to get Hyde, so anybody who did not successfully go along with killing Hyde has been a target of murder, and A.J. Meadows was one of them. Another letter I have from a James Karras Jr. said that his life was threatened by an Officer Horton because he heard threats to Mr. Braswell. I'm using these names on the air because Soledad Prison, it seems far away maybe to people in Boston or Sacramento or other stations listening to the show, and you may wonder, what are all these murders out in the California prisons that are taking place? But these are witnesses to how Donald DeFries got out of Soledad Prison, how the SLA was formed, so that there's been threats on the life of Robert Hyde, on James Karras, on Mr. Meadows, on Mr. Braswell, and many of the original team that knew Donald DeFries have moved. Some have gone to Tehachapi, some to Chino. Another one was just moved up to San Quentin. They're splitting them up and around. If you take it lightly, remember the story of Ron Wood that we went into just about a month ago, the prisoner who was in a cell next to Sirhan Sirhan, and then when he was moved to Nevada, sent letters out. He wanted to contact Playboy. He knew of the second gun that killed Robert Kennedy, and that Sirhan didn't kill Robert Kennedy. And so Ron Wood was shortly after that murdered in the jail, and he was murdered because of what he knew. So I don't take these letters lightly that I receive, and I want to read them on the air from time to time at length to show you that these are not motiveless murders that you're reading about in the prisons that are taking place. The newspaper looks like that. They're called suicide or motiveless murders, but they're not at all. And they have some political connotations, a lot of them. Besides gang warfare and narcotics traffic and so forth, there's a lot of political cover-up, and particularly of the SLA. That story has to hold, or else it would blow the SLA story to smithereens if the real nature of the way the CIA and the police department and the Department of Corrections met to create this little fictitious army, the cover story that it was a radical group, simply has to hold so that future radicals can lean on it and have something to justify what they're doing. They're following the example of the SLA. That reminds me of the domino theory of the assassinations that I always refer to. If you can take an intelligence, military intelligence agent like Oswald and call him the lone assassin, then you can take the next assassin like James Ray and say he was influenced by Oswald, and you can take the murder of Robert Kennedy, and you can. This is what the government did, and say Sirhan was influenced by James Ray and Lee Harvey Oswald, then you can take Arthur Brammer, who's influenced by the others. There's that domino theory of political assassinations, which the intelligence agencies use in the United States, and they do the same thing with the radical terrorist group. They get an airplane and blow it up. TWA, this last week, it came out that there was probably a bomb. Today, they're trying to link it to a radical group. They can cause a lot of damage around the country, like blowing up the Pan American offices or lockers down in Los Angeles where three people are killed, and then link it to these terrorist groups. If you don't have a first terrorist group, you can't have a third, fourth, fifth, or sixth, and the fictitious nature of them would be exploded if we investigated each one of these cases one by one. Now I'm going to two books, two series of books. One's a book, and the other are a series of books that I want to recommend, because on this program, Dialogue Conspiracy, we can't go into a lot of this material every week when you can have access to these documents yourself. A new book came just today in the mail. I've been waiting for it a long time. It's called Big Brother and the Holding Company, The World Behind Watergate. It's published by Ramparts Press, and because it's new, I think you could ask bookstores, the Thunderbird and Carmel probably will be carrying it. Wherever you hear the show, ask them if they'll carry this book. It's an important book. It's cost $10. It's called Big Brother and the Holding Company, The World Behind Watergate, published by Ramparts. And it's got important articles that have been published in the last 2 years on the Watergate, compiled into one book, and it's in the conspiratorial aspect of Watergate, and it's into the parts Jaworski said we haven't opened up yet. It's all the parts that he didn't open up, and it's got a foreword by Noam Chomsky in there. Then there's a section, Crying Wolf at the Watergate, and it goes into the nature, the insidious nature of the espionage teams and how they work as a team, the various groups that have broken down. There's a section by Steve Weissman on the Tom Houston plan. We hear so much about it, but it briefly touches the competition between the Defense Intelligence Agency and the CIA, and it fingers William Sullivan, who I have done in my realist articles, of the DIA taking papers from J. Edgar Hoover and actually running the FBI from over at John Ehrlichman's desk. There's a section by Richard Popkind on the San Diego coup, and Popkind wrote the book The Second Oswald. There's a section by Fred Cook setting up the veterans, the Vietnam veterans. Fred Cook wrote The Warfare State and the FBI Nobody Knows. There's a part by Don Fried called Gemstone, and it goes into the, again, the detailed plans of a three-layered intelligence operation coming out of the White House, the Haldeman desk, the Segretti operations, the Chapin operations, the violence for the conventions, the use of the Nazi Party. There's one by Peter Dale Scott, who's a very fine researcher. It's called From Dallas to Watergate, The Longest Cover-Up. Peter Dale Scott wrote a book called The War Conspiracy, and he has an unpublished book on the John Kennedy assassination. Barbara Fried wrote one chapter in here called Flight 553, The Watergate Murder with a question mark, and it's an excellent chapter on the murder of Mrs. Dorothy Hunt and persons on the airplane that crashed December 8, 1972 in Chicago. There's another one on Stop McGovern, the political use of the Watergate teams to manipulate the elections, and a chapter on C. Arnold Smith and the San Diego connections. There's a chapter called The Money Men, and this goes into Maurice Stans and Rebozo, the United Fruit Company, and the connections from Spain, and the washing, the money washing. There's one on the lawyers, Nixon, Mudge, Rose, Guthrie, Alexander, and Mitchell, the law firms involved in the Watergate, written by somebody by the name of Frappier. An excellent thing. There's diagrams in there of money washing. There's a chapter on Charles Colson, the super spy. All of these chapters I have read separately in my research. I have received this documentation, and some of it I've shared with you at KLRB. It's all put into one volume. There's the famous article by Jeff Gerth on Nixon and the Miami Connection. You may have received the article in Sundance magazine, November, December 72. But the Sundance is a small magazine. In fact, it went out of business, I believe, after that issue, unfortunately. But it's small, you know, like The Realist, it doesn't get as wide a coverage as a book like this could get. And it's important to get this book. And then there's that famous article of Kirkpatrick Sale called The World Behind Watergate, The Cowboys, and The Yankees. Some of you remember these titles and these long articles, but they're all in one book. There's one by Steve Weissman called The Cowboys and the Crooks. And then there's a whole section on glossary of government espionage terms and a copy of the COINTELPRO documents, the FBI disruption of the left, and a copy of the whole Houston plan and some White House memos with a lot of bibliography. It's an excellent book. Big Brother and the Holding Company, The World Behind Watergate. The editor is Steve Weissman, put out by Rampart. It just came out this week. The other book that you should get, there's a series of books. I mentioned one before on the program. It's called The Breaking of a President. It's going to be a five-part volume. Actually, four are out already. And you can send for these. Some of them you can buy at the bookstore, maybe. The Breaking of a President. Ask around. I bought my copies at Monterey at the post office at the bookstand. I don't think they're out at the Thunderbird, but you can write. It's called Collector's Publications. Collector's Publications, P.O. Box 3548, City of Industry, California, 91744. Collector's Publications. Now, there's four books out, and there's going to be a fifth book, and the whole set will sell down for $22.50. If you can't afford $22.50, you can buy them separately. But the first one, Breaking of a President, is the photo history of Nixon's blunders. And they have calendars marked in with the event of these different blunders and the White House team of agents. The second book was on the indictment, impeachment, and resignation of Richard Nixon. A photo history. The third volume, which I have here, is Organized Crime Behind Nixon, and that is really a mind blower. I was going to do a whole show on that, but there's so much news that comes in, I just want to mention it to you. Maybe next week we'll go into some of it. The fourth issue is going to be the impeachment debate, the damning Tates, the criminal trials, the pardon, and the resignation. Volume 5 is now some more covering the trial of the Watergate, the cover-up trial. The one on Nixon and the Mafia goes in, here's the table of contents, crime, big business, and Watergate, the Meyer-Lansky connection, the National Crime Syndicate, Tammany's corruption, police bribery up to 1972, how the rich got that way, the Murray-Chotiner connection, the Jimmy Hoffa connection, the Shenley connection, that's between J. Edgar Hoover and the whiskey and prohibition, the Annenberg connection, the Havana connection, the Bahama connection, the Howard Hughes connection, the special interest of Gerald Ford. Nixon should have been prosecuted. And then they've got an invaluable list of Nixon's pardons and commutations. I was sitting and reading some of them yesterday. I was out somewhere waiting for my daughter, and I was reading these and chuckling. And somebody was sitting next to me and realized what I was doing. And he said, "How can you laugh at this? It was so gross." But in the back of this issue on Nixon and the Mafia, it has a list of pardons that he has given, the 5 years that he's been in office, that either sentences were commuted or pardoned. And not only Jimmy Hoffa and Angela DiCarlo, but some of them will go into theft of government property, theft of mail, heroin, false identifications, income tax evasion, forged security, and so forth. There's a list of hundreds of pardons that he gave in the last 6 years, and you would really believe that the criminals are out on the streets. Well, maybe we'll do more of this book next week, but you can order it, and I'll repeat the address next week. Get Big Brother and the Holding Company, do some homework, and we'll meet again next week on Dialogue Conspiracy.
It's time for Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 3 years has shared with us her decades' research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative and judicial processes in America. And now, here's Mae.